This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wild lions, hyenas, rhinos, and elephants are the stars of the movies made by my guests, Derek and Beverly Joubert. The husband and wife team have been making wildlife documentaries for over 25 years. They're based in Botswana and live in tents and their vehicle, which is customized to enable them to film animals close up. They work with the National Geographic Society and are the society's explorers in residence. The Jouberts have a new film called The Last Lions, which follows a lioness who is left on her own to take care of her cubs after the father of her cubs is killed in battle. When she and her cubs are separated from their pride, desperate for food, she makes her way across the delta's waters to an island called Duba that was formed naturally only 20 years ago and had never been populated by lions but was home to herds of buffalo. Eventually, she leads a new pride on this island. The Jouberts titled this film The Last Lions to reflect their fear that wild lions are becoming extinct. There were about 450,000 lions in the mid-20th century when the Jouberts were born, and there are now only an estimated 20 to 25,000. The Jouberts have written a book, also titled The Last Lions, illustrated with Beverly's photos. Beverly and Derek Joubert, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, your film has a kind of main character, a lioness. How did you decide to focus on her story?
Well, Terry, you know, we actually picked up on a couple of stories on the day when we started this project and the series of projects. And her story was the one that prevailed. So this is a character called Madita, which means mother of lions. But we also followed the pride and the males as well. But just the more and more time we spent with them all, she just got stronger and stronger as a story arc.
So the main character is a lioness named Madita, a name you gave her. And the father of her cubs dies after a battle, which we see. And he's fighting with other lions. Would you describe the fight?
Well, it's where the film picks up. We arrive and we start our story on this fateful night when everything changes for her and for her male. But marauders come in from the outside, move into their territory.
Marauding lions.
Yes, marauding lions come in from the outside, move into her territory, their territory, and fight with them. You know, these territorial battles are dramatic and often end up in death one way or the other. And so that's where we start our story. And certain things are put in place that day that completely change everything for her.
So would you describe the actual fight?
Yeah, you know, it's what actually happened was that, first of all, two males came in and her male mate, couldn't do anything but defend his territory. So he went straight in and tried to confront these interlopers. And very often that works out quite well because there's a certain strength of being in control of a territory that sways the sort of fight in your favor, but not in this case. And so these two males surrounded him and attacked him quite brutally, and their females came out of the darkness as well, surrounded Madita, attacked her, and very nearly killed her. It did some serious damage to her shoulder, actually. But it was it went on for about an hour. It was quite a dramatic fight, one of the most dramatic fights we've managed to film in 28 years.
And it was incredibly intense because it all happened at nighttime. And so, you know, it was hard for us to capture every aspect of it, especially struggling with the dark.
How did you get to film this fight, and where were you situated as you were filming?
Well, generally, we're situated about 20 or 30 paces away from the action. With things like this, it's fairly chaotic. You never know where it is going to come from, where it's going to end up. Often the action breaks closer to you than the ideal. In this case, it did happen around about 30 meters away from us. And it was in the first starting of the light of dawn, but not quite enough to register without some sort of assistance from lights. And then as the fight progressed, it got closer and closer to dawn, and we got better and better images. But again, Terry, just chaotic stuff happening all around us, around the back of the vehicle, on the side, in and out of focus, all over the place. And we were lucky to capture anything at all.
So you're in your specially equipped vehicle. And you're like 30 meters away from where these lions are fighting each other. How do you know you're safe?
Well, we know we're safe because the action is all for a purpose. And it's not about us being in their territory. It's definitely about them fighting over a territory. And they're fighting, you know, across their own species. So it's really lions fighting lions. We don't have doors. We don't have a windshield. And we don't have a roof except a little canvas, you know, over it. We believe that our knowledge over 28 years has prepared us to keep safe. And also it's kept us being good filmmakers without ever challenging the animals, without wanting them, you know, to give us that incredible aggressive look. We feel that the luxury of time will eventually give us that look, but we never ever want to threaten an animal. I think it's really all about respect at the end of the day, and we have an ultimate respect, you know, for these animals.
You mentioned that threatening look. The look on some of the lions' faces as they're fighting, it's such a completely different look than when they're just, you know, at peace. And yeah, it's so ferocious. I mean, you literally see like their jaws pulled back and the teeth coming out, and it's really quite frightening.
Well, it is, and it's designed to be, and this is the
maybe
great
I should
thing,
say the word awesome too. It's really awe inspiring.
It's certainly designed to be frightening, because it doesn't really serve anybody, any of the lions in a battle, to get to a point where they actually make contact, get injured and die, because both the victors and the vanquished could get injured fatally within this. These are big animals with sharp teeth and claws. And so all of that stuff is great. All that posturing, all the grimacing and growling and attacking into the throat area in the case of males, that are covered by manes, the function of it, largely is display. It's very, very rare for that display to then upgrade into a point of contact. And that's why this was such a rare thing for us to capture this fight in this early part of the film.
Later in the film, we see lions preying on buffalo because the lions need food and they can eat the buffalo. But if a lion kills a lion, will the lion eat the lion that it killed?
No, the lion will not eat another lion. And in fact, often the lions won't even eat other predators. So if they kill a hyena, they won't eat it either, unless they are in absolute desperate times, you know, maybe at death's door. Lions really don't have to eat other predators.
But I mean, if they're dead already, they still won't eat them.
No, they don't. First of all, other meat eaters don't taste great, which in many ways favors us. We're also meat eaters generally. And so we're not on the normal prey menu item, basically, for these big predators. So the big predators, their preference is to hit buffalo, to kill all the normal herbivores, and very, very rarely another meat eater of any kind. The meat just doesn't taste good.
That's interesting. If you're just joining us, my guests are Derek and Beverly Joubert, and they've been making wildlife films for decades. And their new film, The Last Lions, has just opened, and they also have a companion book of the same name published by National Geographic. And they are explorers in residence at the National Geographic Society. They're based in Botswana. So, you know, in the film, as we've been describing, the lioness that you follow, her mate is killed in battle. And so she has to survive with her cubs without a mate. What does that mean for a lioness to no longer have a mate?
Well, the unusual part of this entire scenario is not only does she not have a mate and a protector and the burden of these three cubs, but she also doesn't have a pride. And that's very, very unusual for lionesses. Usually you get a pride of eight lionesses, and then they pool their cubs. So each one of them has cubs. They look after them up to a certain point. And then all of them look after everybody's cubs. So there's this double layer of protection against something going wrong for these big ultimate killers, because they are in a very, very dangerous profession, so to speak. If they get injured, if they were solitary, they would lose those cubs very easily. And so for her, the stakes were doubly high. She had lost her mate and her protector, and she had to go out and hunt very, very dangerous activity and make sure that she didn't get injured long enough for her to have her cubs vulnerable and in jeopardy.
So she basically stakes out new territory.
Yeah, exactly. So she can't stay in this territory any longer. It's been dominated by the incomers, and she has to find new territory. And for her, that means new territory in an unknown place where there are no lions, and that is across the Duba River onto the Duba Island itself. And that's the beginning of this great adventure.
So she tries to attack buffalo. And there are a lot of buffalo on this island that she has crossed into. And so the buffalo have horns, and the lioness has teeth. How do the horns and teeth match up as weapons?
Well, actually, that is the problem for the lioness. Those horns are incredibly sharp, and if she doesn't attack from the back, she will be ripped apart. In fact, in Duba, not so long ago, we saw a whole pride of lions being wiped out by buffalo purely because they weren't hunting from the back, they were hunting from the front.
And it's like they didn't know how to do it yet?
Exactly. They hadn't specialized in buffalo, and they were probably hunting, you know, various other animals. But when they were confronted with only one prey species, it was a challenge for them. And, of course, they severely lost every member except one. So that was a problem. So her initial stages was having to learn how to hunt. And, of course, right through the film, she studies them. You see that she's watching, she's studying them, and she tries to take the calves because it was in the calving season. It was fortunate for her that it was calving season then. And she starts off with them, but of course eventually in the finale she is hunting a male buffalo bull.
One of the I have to say kind of heartbreaking sequences in the movie, the lioness that we've been talking about, she returns to one of her cubs, and his back is broken, and he can only like drag himself with his front paws, and the rest of his body just lies limply as he drags himself. And she finally turns away and leaves him. And what is your understanding of why the lioness leaves her disabled cub behind?
Well, it's a moment in the film, and it is sad, heartbreaking, although those sort of things have been going on for 3.5 million years. The 3.5 million years that lions have been in their present shape and form in Africa. So it's very hard for us to judge and to say what she was going through is wrong, or what her reaction to it was wrong. But what was interesting for us from the scene, and fortunately, the end of the film has a happy ending, which sort of counterbalances this. But what was interesting for us from the scene was that at that moment, we had this incredible opportunity to have an insight into the potential that these animals have real emotions. You've seen the film, and so you know that there's a moment in there where this lioness on camera blinks twice, closes her eyes, and then swallows deeply. And while we can't anthropomorphize, we can certainly understand that there's something going on, and that I think it would be arrogant of us to actually think that we have the exclusive rights on emotions. Animals have emotions as well. We just don't understand what form they take. But for us, this moment in the film was much more about her reaction, her struggling with that inevitable maternal instinct to stay and to take care of the cub when she knew she didn't have that capability.
Did it cross your mind that maybe you should do something to help save this cub, or would that have been crossing a line for you?
We made a policy years ago that we're out there to document, and that's what we do. And we'll never intervene when it's a natural situation. So when it's nature playing out its game without human interference, then we're completely hands off, and all that we do is document, even though it's painful. But if we see a situation that is a man-made situation. For instance, an animal falling into a man-made waterhole, or a snared animal, or poachers shooting at animals. We do. We go straight in. We've had this happen before, where poachers have been shooting into elephants, and, you know, not even thinking about our own safety, we've driven straight towards them, straight, you know, to confront them, and hopefully that they will stop shooting. These poachers on that particular day knew that they were in the wrong, and they ran to the river and they dropped their weapons and jumped into a boat.
Now, you know, we were talking about the lioness returning to her cubs and having to abandon a cub who had a broken back. The pride of lions that you followed, you say they killed over 90 cubs in about 5 or 6 years. Why would lions kill their own cubs?
Well, we don't know. But if you look at the opposite end of that argument, which is, had they not killed all these cubs, this isolated island in the middle of Botswana in the Okavango Duba Plains would now have 100 lions on it. So clearly there has to be a natural weeding out of some of the animals, certainly some of the predators. The fact that it's so unusual for these lionesses to kill cubs within their own pride is indeed a mystery to us. We don't know why they're doing it, and it's happening today, actually. So we don't know how long it's going to carry on, and if this is just something unique to this area or to this pride. Again, I don't think that we have exclusive rights on weirdness.
And would, in this situation, does the lioness kill another lion's cubs or kill her own?
No,
they never kill their own cubs. They always kill another lioness's cubs. I also think that it could be a function of the newness of the pride. They're sort of feeling each other out. There's anxiety within the pride. Certainly, it's an intense situation. It might be the fact that they're on a daily basis, they're in these intense situations with the buffalo. We don't know, but every now and again, when we do film a mother lioness coming back and finding her cubs killed, she sometimes eats those cubs, which is strange. But it's a mystery.
No, do lions attack elephants?
Yes, lions do attack elephants, but this is also only happens in various areas. And in fact, it hadn't been filmed until, I think it was run about 1995, that we captured it in Botswana in the Savuti region. And it was because there was an intense drought. A lot of the animals had either died in the area or moved out. And it was just breeding herds of elephants that were moving from one water system, one river system to the other, that was about 70 kilometers apart. And in this area, the lions had to adapt. If they didn't adapt to attempting to hunt elephants, they too would have died. And that's exactly what happened. Over this period, we captured them hunting only at nighttime, and they would first of all bring down some of the babies, and then later they were bringing down a 12-year-old, and then we eventually captured them trying to bring down a 21-year-old cow.
Yeah, now here's what I'm wondering. You know, you've seen the world of nature through the eyes of lions and through the eyes of elephants, and lions have attacked those elephants. So, like, do you have shifting loyalties when you're watching these fights, depending on whether the film is about elephants or whether the film is about lions?
Well, no. You know, we've been doing this for a long time. We've been doing this for 28 years, nearly 30 years now. And so we're totally comfortable with our emotions and the fact that we can be emotionally distraught one way or the other. But all of these behaviors have been going on for so long. In the case of the lion-elephant things, there's good evidence that lions in a previous form, saber-teeth smilodons, were hunting mammoths. And so these sort of behaviors have been going on a long time. What our role is to be there, be in the right place, get it in focus, document it, and then maybe go one step further and through the writing and the script and maybe some of the camera work, show people a little bit about what it was like to be there on the day.
Absolutely. And I can tell you, Terry, we do take an immense amount of pain. The emotional drain is huge. But often we look at the only reason that we can bring it into the edited version is because we've gone through that emotional drainage. And so I believe it's probably good for us, although on the day, it truly does hurt. It's like losing a family member. And it doesn't matter if it's a lion or if it's an elephant. It truly hurts. We have total respect for the end of an animal's life. We would never celebrate and go, yay, we got it. You know, isn't that wonderful? We totally do a little mourning ritual within ourselves just by being silent and being very respectful.
I know you don't like to anthropomorphize in your work. You don't like to project human emotions onto the animals. But some, you know, a few of the film critics have pointed out that the narration seems to do just that, to attribute some human emotions, you know, and a kind of human kind of narrative to the story of the lines that you're following.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that there's probably a misunderstanding of anthropomorphisms then. What we are very, very careful about doing and have been through all of our films and in this one as well, and in fact it goes through a rigorous fact-checking process at National Geographic, is being very careful about how we deal with what are obviously emotions within these animals. So we never, ever say, and I never write into a script, I'll never say, this animal is feeling sadness and this animal is feeling hatred, or any of those sort of things. What I try to do very carefully is say, we don't know about animal emotions, but any mother who loses her young must be going through something. And so I'd like to take people up to that point and then do a handover, because it's very, very obvious that these animals do have emotions. But exactly what form those emotions take, I think, is where we've got to draw the line and stop short. Anybody who thinks that humans are the only animals on the planet that have emotions clearly has never had a dog or a cat or a bird.
What's the biggest risk you took for a shot in your new film, The Last Lions?
Well, we have a fairly risky life, so the biggest risk is sort of off the charts. I think that probably it was in following the lions across the river systems. This is a very, very tricky area to operate in. It floods up, and the lions have to swim a lot of the time. To get unique shots, we would push our vehicle in, push it to extremes, and on one occasion, I know we actually just had a new vehicle made for us, and we pushed that in, got deeper and deeper and deeper, until eventually the water was sort of mid-chest height on me as I was sitting driving. And then we hit deep water and stuck and got stuck, had the vehicle lodged in the sand there, and had to swim out to try and get a winch cable across. But the riskiest part of that was 2 days before, we'd been filming some of the biggest crocodiles in the area right at that spot. So there was no way of knowing where these crocodiles were. And I got to tell you that every little thing that brushed against my legs as I was swimming out was a big croc in my mind.
But you don't really know for sure what it was.
We have no idea. I'm sure they were little fish.
But in fact, I often joke about that day, because Derek truly did turn the vehicle into a submerged submarine. And it was hair-raising for two reasons. We were losing all our camera gear. All our camera gear went down with the vehicle. And then, of course, we were stuck in the water ourselves. And so, first of all, before we even tried to get ourselves out, we first had to save the camera gear. And that was hair-raising, because we had to open up these silver boxes that are attached to the vehicle, let more water flood down all over them, and then throw them to the back of the canvas roof that was sticking out. And of course, we had no idea, you know, $2 million worth of camera gear. We had no idea if we were going to save them or not. And of course, to have an insurance on that amount of gear, the way we live, we wouldn't be able to afford it. So we didn't have insurance on it. But it was very fortunate that we saved at least 85% of the gear.
Was a lot of your footage within those cameras? I'm assuming they're digital cameras.
Just the day's worth of shooting, so not that much.
Okay.
So we were lucky on that in that regard.
Yeah. In fact, we often joke that what we really lost was our pride more than anything else, and the line pride.
Dignity and pride.
So Beverly, while Derek was swimming out to try to find a cable to pull the vehicle back, or to pull the vehicle out of the ditch. Yeah.
This is a very, very good question, Terry.
The question I was going to ask before you praise it is, where were you, Beverly?
Yeah, this is a good question.
I was in the vehicle. I had climbed to the roof of the vehicle because obviously, you know, putting all the gear up was very important. I was fairly dry, but I was documenting. You know, it's so important when situations like this happen to document. Often we've lived through the most hair-raising situation and haven't managed to capture it on film at all. And so this was my moment and my excuse not be in the water.
Beverly sort of brushed over the one part of that sentence there. She was dry.
So Derek, you actually swam to shore, found a cable, and pulled out the vehicle from the rut it was in?
Yeah, well, rut is an understatement. We eventually managed to get the vehicle out of there. It took us a day, but... Yeah, and these are the sort of things that we're up against all the time. And ironically, Terry, you know, it's not the big things that will get you. It's the little things. In our lives, there have been a lot of scorpion stings, snake bites, malaria. I've had malaria 4 times. So it's really those sort of things that'll do you in. And it's ironic, you know, we've spent more time with lions than we spent collectively at school, university, or with our parents, and we've never been scratched by a lion. So obviously, we're in our comfort zone here.
Beverly, you do the audio for the movies.
Yes, that's right.
And the sound is great. For example, like the almost bark of the young cubs, especially the young cub whose back is broken and who's kind of calling to his mother. There's such like interesting and emotional sounds, and of course, there's the growls during. At the beginning of fights when the lions are really showing how tough they're going to be and trying to scare the other animals. How do you mic them?
Terry, it is mainly with directional mics, like a 416 Sennheiser or an 816 Sennheiser. And, you know, I'm in the vehicle. Whilst Derek is shooting, I'll be doing the recording and then, of course, also doing the photography. So I sort of juggle between the two. And they are beautiful sounds. The lions are communicating amongst each other all the time. If the lions have all been sleeping together for hours, we always know that we'll know when they get up, even if we've taken a nap, because there's that little call, that social call, when they rub heads and greet each other. And then, of course, when the cubs are calling each other, it's almost what I suppose, you know, cats are doing a meow, but it's their form. It really is this sometimes can be quite aggressive and sometimes quite whiny when the cubs are demanding milk from Madital. But she is always aware of where they are through their communications, and they're always aware of where she is because she's communicating with them most of the time when they're in close proximity. Obviously, when she goes off hunting, she doesn't communicate with them at all. And then I think the fascinating with the audio is when the lions start roaring and are communicating sort of 5 kilometers or more with another pride. And that's really to say, this is my territory, back off. You can't come in here.
And do you ever is the audio always as good as the film quality and vice versa, or do you ever end up taking a growl that sounds better from another scene and putting it in the scene that you're using?
You know, often with the audio, it is a challenge to get the audio at all times, especially when there's a huge amount of activity happening, and I might be assisting Derek to try and capture it, or as well as trying to capture as a still image as well. And then sometimes I would have to do that. But majority of the time, we would need to get what is there on the day. Otherwise, we might be miscommunicating what the lions were saying on the day. Even though we don't understand lion language, we do try and get it as accurate as possible. But often, you know, I could never get the tiny rustle of the grass or those immense splashes as they're going off in the distance. So that's when we'll bring in a Foley artist.
Now, your movie and your book are called The Last Lions, and you're concerned that lions may be becoming extinct. You'd like to see them put on the endangered species list, wild lions. You say when you started doing this kind of work, documenting large cats, there were how many lions then?
Well, when Beverly and I were born roughly 50 years ago, there were 450,000 lions, and now those numbers are down to around 20,000. That represents a 90-95% decline. And so the reason that we took on this book and the film was to try and get that message and the preciousness of these individual lives that are now only 20,000 strong in front of a bigger audience, in front of people around the world, so that we can start having this conversation. Unless we start talking about this, these lions will be extinct within the next 10 or 15 years. And that's not something that we're prepared to see happen on our watch.
Of the 20,000 lions that are left, why are only 4,500 male?
Well, that's the normal breakdown. So there's a greater drop-off rate of young males. So they're born at about 50-50, one male, one female in the cub litter. But by the time the young males and young females leave and go into their nomadic phase, the young females are better prepared to hunt. The young males are less prepared to hunt. And so they wander off and more young males die. When those males come back into the system as resident male lions, the general breakdown is that you might have two male lions to a pride of 8 or 9, 10 females. And so that sort of settles then at that stage. And so you're right. Of the 20,000, we've got between 3,500 and 4,000 male lions left.
So are you saying that the lionesses are more of the hunters than the lions?
Always are, yes. The lionesses are better adapted to hunting than males are.
Why is that?
Again, a lot of it has not to do with the fact that males are lazy. I would never go on record saying that. but they're, you know, they've got these enormous black manes a lot of the time, and that just makes it harder for them to creep up on other animals for a start. The manes make them about a certain percentage, I think it's 12%, less efficient because it keeps them hotter and they've got relatively small hearts. The manes, of course, are vitally important to them because it protects their necks and the jugular vein structures during fights. But the manes weigh against them in the equality of hunting prowess.
Now, in terms of conservation, you do your part in various ways, not only by making the films, but one of the things you say you've done is to purchase lion and leopard hunting permits and then tear them up. Is there like only a certain number of hunting permits that are allowed to be given per year? So if you tear them up, you're eliminating somebody else's opportunity to use that permit?
Well, yes, that was the idea, and that's certainly something that we were doing some years ago. As it happens now, you can't shoot a male lion in Botswana. So the fantastic news is that all lions in Botswana now have maximum protection. There are a number of other countries as well that are following suit. Very soon we won't even have to go down this route, but governments issue a certain number of hunting licenses. And in places where those are inappropriate, or if we feel that that we have some sort of influence and we can acquire those licenses, then they get taken off the market. But more and more, that's not becoming necessary now.
You've said that Botswana is African wildlife conservation's model citizen, Zimbabwe the opposite. Would you compare Zimbabwe and Botswana when it comes to the conservation of wildlife?
Well, certainly. I think that, by the way, I think that it may have been in response to what we felt about what was going on in Zimbabwe, but I think there are worse culprits than Zimbabwe, actually. In Botswana, of course, the entire system is working very, very well. So somewhere between 35 and 40% of the entire country is set aside for wildlife. That's enormous when you think of the global average, which is way, way down. Is it 12%, Beverly, I think?
Yes, 12% of the landmass on the planet is protected national parks.
So obviously in Botswana, way ahead of the game on that. A very, very stable government. A president, President Ian Khama, who's custodian of the wildlife and very, very avid conservationist. The Minister of Environment and Wildlife is great. He completely gets it. Stable government, good economy, and a small human population, so 1.5, 1.7 million people. So all of those sort of factors work in favor of Botswana being the paradise for wildlife in Africa. Other countries have bigger problems. Kenya, for instance, has an enormous human population and great pressure on its national parks. In other places, there's no revenue stream, so they turn to hunting, and in particular, the hunting of these big cats, and that's damaging in certain cases.
So you are married. You live in two tents in Botswana, and you live part-time in your vehicle as well. You see lots of animals. It sounds like you don't see a lot of people. Do you ever feel like you've become disconnected from your own species as you watch wild animals?
You know, I don't think so. I think we've been fairly disciplined about the length of time that we spend in the field and then coming out again. Obviously, when we edit a film like this, we're in town for 2 years. That's how long it took us to edit The Last Lions. So during that time, we were saturated with all of the cultural things that we may be missing when we're out in the field for 2 years. For us, certainly this balance works very, very well.
But I think what we practice, and it's really what philosophers and poets have always done, they would remove themselves from the hustle and bustle and chaos of humanity and be in a quiet place. And that's really what we do. We are able to reflect and to connect and see where we're going as a society. And then when we're in society, you know, we obviously are able to see what the importances of certain things are and where we might be misleading ourselves. And so I think it's really important to actually have the balance. I think everybody should have the balance, but it wouldn't have to necessarily be the balance that we have that is more of nature.
So in the years that you've been making wildlife movies, you've witnessed, you say, a few thousand kills. Would you compare your reaction the first few times you saw a wild animal kill another animal to what your reaction is now?
Interesting. I think that the first time was adrenaline-filled, highly anxiety-driven moment for both of us, maybe more so for Beverly. And it is like an amazing ride, but it also it's a real privilege to be there at the moment of transferal of energy from a dead form from a live form to a dead form. And also it's similar to what happens at birth. Actually, you've seen something change in the planet, and today I don't think much has changed for us. I think each one of these moments is precious, and we, as Beverly said early on, we sit back and we quiet, we pay reverence to it. We never have any sort of graveyard humor about it, definitely. But we certainly recognize the importance of any death.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you.
We really appreciate it.
Derek and Beverly Joubert have a new wildlife documentary and a companion book. Both are titled The Last Lions. You can see a slideshow of Beverly's photos of lions on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, Pym, that updates Edgar Allan Poe's only novel. This is Fresh Air. Matt Johnson is a biracial writer whose work often satirizes racial issues in America. His novel, Hunting in Harlem, took up the topic of gentrification. His graphic novel, Incognegro, is a noir mystery that investigated the subject of passing. Johnson's new novel is called Pym, and if that title rings a bell, it's because Edgar Allan Poe used it first. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Johnson's updating of Poe's only novel.
If all you think of when you think of Edgar Allan Poe are poems like The Raven or tales of terror like The Fall of the House of Usher, you might not realize that Poe was a funny guy. I'm not talking belly laughs, but more a creepy comic vision that savored the absurd in desperate situations, like an annoying corpse whose darn heart just won't stop thumping, or, spoiler alert, a whodunit where the killer turns out to be an orangutan. It's this strain of ghastly humor in Poe that Matt Johnson mines in his new novel, Pym, an inventive and socially sassy play on Poe's one and only novel, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. Poe published The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym in 1838, trying as always to make some money from his writing by cashing in on the public's thirst for novels and newfound curiosity about Antarctica. Masquerading as authentic journal entries, the tale chronicles the voyages of a young seafarer, Pym, who suffers through mutiny, shipwreck, and cannibalism. But buried alive deep in Poe's icy adventure tale is the ultimate scary subject in 19th century American literature, slavery. The narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym keeps hallucinating about race. A black crew member heads the mutiny. Pym and some survivors of the shipwreck drift to an island near the blinding whiteness of the South Pole, where, lo and behold, all the inhabitants are black. Even their teeth are black, and these folks are terrified of whiteness. At the abrupt end of Poe's novel, a giant white shrouded figure rises up out of a frozen chasm and, well, that's all he wrote. Not surprisingly, the fragmented jumble of the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym was not a bestseller, and Poe himself later dismissed it as a very silly book. Silly, certainly, and also haunted by the specter of race. As a black writer, Matt Johnson has a blast chasing all the pale ghosts out of Poe's ice caverns and updating this master text of anxious white fright. In Johnson's Pym, our hero, Chris Janes, is a professor of African American literature, or as he calls himself, a professional Negro. When the novel opens, Janes has just been denied tenure for refusing to serve on his college's diversity committee and for going off the farm, as he puts it, to teach a course on his passion, the work of Edgar Allan Poe. The course, in a twist on a Toni Morrison title, is called Dancing with the Darkies, Whiteness in the Literary Mind, and Janes explains its focus this way. My work, it's about finding the answer to why we have failed to truly become a post-racial society. It's about finding the cure. 1,000 Baldwin and Ellison essays can't do this. You have to go to the source. That's why I started focusing on Poe. If we can identify how the pathology of whiteness was constructed, then we can learn how to dismantle it. The college doesn't buy Janes's rap about the key to America's race problem lying in classic white texts. Instead, he's promptly replaced with a hip-hop theorist. But Janes is undaunted. He decides to recreate the voyage of Poe's hero, Arthur Gordon Pym. Like Pym, Janes literally seeks to travel to the source of pure whiteness, the South Pole, but this time in the company of an all-black crew. Janes has found a manuscript that suggests that the lost black civilization near the pole that Poe described in his novel might be real, and he wants to make contact. But instead, he and his crew discover a prehistoric world of giant white people, snow honkies, who enslave them. I'll stop there, but Johnson's inventiveness never does. This is a comic nightmare in which Little Debbie snack cakes and the luminous paintings of a Thomas Kincaid-like schlock artist play crucial roles. Johnson even comes up with intra-racial jokes about global warming. One black guy trekking through the tundra with Janes surveys a crack in the South Pole ice and immediately denies responsibility by saying, "Ain't our fault. It was all them Escalades in the ghetto." Loony, disrespectful, and sharp, Matt Johnson's Pym is a welcome riff on the surrealistic shudder fest that is Poe's original. As Johnson implicitly points out, these traditional Heart of Darkness narratives take on a whole different hue when the explorer's telescope is seized by other hands.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the novel Pym by Matt Johnson. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Jazz saxophonist and composer Sonny Rollins is one of the 10 recipients of the National Medal of the Arts, presented today by President Obama at the White House. Other recipients include Van Cliburn, Quincy Jones, Meryl Streep, poet Donald Hall, theater critic Robert Brustein, and writer Harper Lee. So we're joining in the festivities by closing with a Sonny Rollins recording from 1958. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.